Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Welcome back to another episode of the Damage Report. I am John Arola. It is Thursday, and it is a very big day. We are thrilled that later on in the show, we're going to be joined once again by Congressman Ro Khanna. He's going to be joining us to talk about his recently proposed Internet Bill of Rights, which covers a lot of extremely interesting areas, areas, in fact, where government policy has become far worse over the past few years as gigantic data breaches have become so commonplace that we barely even cover them anymore. So he's going to be breaking down all of that. In addition to that, though, we have got so many important stories to talk about. We are going to be covering Jair Bolsonaro, the sort of proto-dictatorial potential next president of Brazil. We're going to be going over his history of absolutely horrendous quotes on a number of different topics. And then beyond that, who is the most bullied person in the world? You might be surprised to find out who it is. We'll cover that and whether or not they actually are being remotely honest about it. Later on in the show, new cases of voter suppression just a month out from the midterm elections, super important there. And we're going to be closing out the show with a little bit more good news. Have Trump supporters started to get tired of Trump's shtick? We'll break down the evidence a little bit later on the show. But all that, you know, a little bit more for you as well. Oh, one other topic. So the fear-mongering about MS-13, obviously ridiculous. And you would expect that, yes, some common Trump supporters will be sort of fooled by that, but not like the wealthy, educated people. No, they actually are. And you will be shocked to find out what they're doing to prepare for the invasion of MS-13. That'll be a little bit later on the show. But we're starting off with Brazil. Brazil recently had the first round of their presidential voting that resulted in Jair Bolsonaro, the far-right candidate, receiving 46% of the vote. That means that there will actually be a runoff election because he did not break the 50% threshold necessary for him to simply clinch the presidential position outright. Now, him succeeding and far exceeding the vote share of the second place candidate is worrisome because he has said a lot of pretty scary things and he represents a potential backsliding of democracy in Brazil. Now, that is my position. Thankfully, the media, I think, has been pretty good in making that clear. And considering how generally uninterested American media is in what happens in the domestic politics of other countries, that's actually surprising. But not universally good news because the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal has decided to, it's generous to say, whitewash his record, if not pretty much outright endorse Jair Bolsonaro in advance of this runoff election. I want to read three quotes from their editorial, which of course you can read yourself if you'd like. They say, and look at how they pitch this. Remember we were talking earlier this week about how most of right-wing thought these days is wanting to make the libs cry, basically? You'll catch a little bit of that in this editorial from the Wall Street Journal. Global progressives are having an anxiety attack over the near triumph Sunday of Brazil's conservative presidential candidate Jair Bolsonaro. After years of corruption and recession, apparently millions of Brazilians think an outsider is exactly what the country needs. Maybe they know more than the world scolds. So those of us who are worried about another dictatorship in Brazil are the world scolds now. And there are two awesome things there, or actually three. We're having an anxiety attack over concerns over backsliding on democracy. Seems like the sort of thing that you probably want to have an anxiety attack over. Second of all, he's conservative, just conservative. We're going to take a look at his record and you be the judge of whether that's an apt depiction of his actual political ideology. Let's see. Third, that they need an outsider. So I want to read the second quote. Remember, this is from the same editorial. Mr. Bolsonaro, who has spent 27 years in Congress, let's pause right there. They just called him a political outsider who has been in Congress for a good portion of a lifetime, actually. But fine, they can square those two things. He's best understood as a conservative populist who promises to make Brazil great for the first time. The 63-year-old is running on traditional values and often says politically incorrect things about identity politics that inflame his opponents. So we're going to give you examples of these politically incorrect things about identity politics. And again, I want you to remember this quote and see if their depiction of what he's doing is honest or if they are attempting to completely whitewash his record to convince you that he's not that far out of the mainstream. He's not so bad. But third quote here, and this is where we're going to transition into some of the things that he said, is opponents claim Mr. Bolsonaro's praise for the military and sometimes for the military rule from 1964 to 1985, pre-democracy in Brazil, by the way, suggests he is a threat to democracy. But he isn't proposing to change the Constitution, which constrains the military at home. And this is where the truth comes in, because first of all, we're not going to read the quote, but their next paragraph actually says how he plans to change the Constitution. So again, I think that they gave like the even paragraphs to one author and the odd paragraphs to another, and they didn't actually talk during it. But there they say, oh, his praise for the military, they say it's a threat to democracy. Well, look, the editorial board for the Wall Street Journal can't actually be bothered to look at what he has actually said, so let me do that for them. I will read some quotes from Jair Bolsonaro, and you say if libs are being hyperbolic in saying that he's potentially a threat to democracy. First of all, he said this, I am in favor of a dictatorship. That's a strong one. It almost seems like perhaps he's not pro-democracy. But lest you believe that, let's move on. He also said, we will never resolve serious national problems with this irresponsible democracy. That seems like the sort of thing that you might want to reference in your editorial, Wall Street Journal. So just to be clear, he wants a dictatorship and he considers democracy irresponsible. Yeah, I would say that liberals being concerned about the future of democracy in Brazil seems warranted considering the words of the actual guy you are purporting to profile in the Wall Street Journal. Let's see. He has said more, though. He has called Brazil under dictatorship a, quote, glorious period in Brazil's history, and said that the only mistake the dictatorship made was preferring torture over outright killing. So, best case scenario, you can say that that is an anti-torture position, sort of. But not really. So a glorious period. When they were doing mass killings, roundups, death squads, stuff like that. That's not an actual mistake. They should have done more outright killing. But lest you believe that he is only interested in a dictatorship in Brazil, he actually likes them in other places as well. In 1998, he praised Augusto Pinochet, the former dictator of Chile, saying the regime should have killed more people.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic. Or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
I mean, look, I think that's unfair because they really tried to kill a lot of people. Like, come on, dude. In the 1990s, he said that if he's ever elected president, remember, he might be president soon, he would stage a military coup of his own on the very first day. I will say, if you're interested in an outsider, out-of-the-box thinking, it's not generally the person who just won power in a country that stages a coup. But I get where he's going with it. He would not be happy with the sort of powers normally given to a democratically elected president in Brazil. He instead wants absolute power as a dictator. So again, they claim that he's a threat to democracy. He claims he's a threat to democracy. He promises that he's a threat to democracy. But the Wall Street Journal can't actually be bothered to quote the guy himself. Now look, this is by far the biggest issue with Bolsonaro, is that he apparently wants to, as is often the case around the world, ride into power through democracy and then shut the door after he's in and get rid of it and remove democracy as a future way that the people could get power back again. But there are other concerns with him as well. He is an incredibly, in their words, I'm a lib, so I think he's offensive and says things about identity politics. Okay, well, look, they don't actually quote him there. They don't give you any evidence to decide whether they're being honest there. So why don't we read some of his quotes and see if he's just saying politically incorrect things. Here's a few quotes of many on homosexuality. He says, quote, if I see two men kissing in the street, I will beat them. If your child starts to become like that, a little gay, you take a whip and you change their behavior. He said he'd rather have a son die in an accident than turn out to be gay. And well, I guess it would save him the trouble of having to whip the kid. And he said, quote, liberal habits and working women have caused an increase in the number of gay people. For context, he said that to Ellen Page, who is a gay actress. So that's on homosexuality. So what does he think about women? He said to a female legislator, I would not rape you. You don't merit that. And then after people were frustrated with him for saying that the only reason he won't rape a woman is because she's not hot enough to deserve it, he went on Twitter and said that he had put her in her, quote, proper place. Now, here's the thing. He is commonly called in Western media Brazil's Trump or Tropical Trump, a label that he doesn't seem to like, although we'll go into some of the more evidence on that. But I want to read some of his quotes, and you'll sort of get how philosophically they're kind of similar. He called the United Nations International Human Rights Day, quote, the day of losers. So he didn't say losers and haters, to be fair, but he did say losers. He was worried about people from Haiti coming in and spreading disease, which is something Donald Trump has said. He called refugees from Syria the scum of the earth, which might actually be farther than what Donald Trump has said on them. Although, to be fair, he does want to bar them from actually coming here, and he wants to condemn them to dying in their own country. On race, in 2011, during an appearance on a television program, he was asked by a famous Afro-Brazilian actress, Preta Gil, what he would do if his son fell in love with a black woman. And he replied, I am not going to discuss promiscuity. He then added that he doesn't run that risk because his sons, quote, are very well raised, telling the actress that they, quote, don't live in the type of environment that you unfortunately do. Wow, that is something. So issues with homosexuality, refugees, weird views on disease, race, women, very misogynistic, all of that. But like I said, he does reject the idea that he's Brazil's Trump. Although, to be fair, in 2016, he said, I like Trump's position. The only difference is that I'm richer. He's not politically correct, and that's why he's massacred by left-wing media. So I like that the guy who wants a dictatorship and a military coup casually throws around the word massacre. That seems like a bad call. But again, to return to the Wall Street Journal, this is what he has actually said. And I would imagine that an organization with the history and the resources and the manpower that you have, that on the odd opportunity, which does not often come, where you decide to effectively endorse a foreign leader as the next president of that country, you could at the very least do a little bit of research and be minimally intellectually honest with your readership about what this person actually represents. But of course, that's not what you're interested in. You have a narrative to push. And by the way, that narrative barely has anything to do with Brazil. Do you honestly think that they are that invested in the future leadership of Brazil? I'm sure that they're fine with it, and they don't mind a far right winger getting in there if he stops some left wing Brazilian from becoming president. But this is about the normalization, not of Jair Bolsonaro, but of leaders like him. This is for the far right leadership that's trying to move up in the ranks in Europe. This is for Donald Trump and others like him in the US as well. Because if you can get the American people to accept Jair Bolsonaro, a guy who says he wants a military coup, he wants to whip gays, and he will rape only the hottest women, then they will accept any sort of white nationalist, racist a-hole in America as well. And I believe that that is the goal of that editorial in the Wall Street Journal. Okay. With that said, we are going to take our first break. When we come back, Ro Khanna, a congressman, is going to be joining us. He is proposing a fairly all-encompassing internet bill of rights. Very exciting stuff that we'll break down after this. Not long ago, a data breach at Facebook exposed the personal data of tens of millions of users at the very least. And that's the sort of tech nightmare that has become so commonplace that, honestly, do you even remember that happening? So, look, considering that, is it time for some sort of internet bill of rights? And we are lucky enough to be joined on the Damage Report now by a congressman, Ro Khanna, who is proposing exactly that. Ro Khanna, welcome to the show.
Great to be back on.
Great to have you back on. And I'm very excited about this most recent proposal of yours. I mean, you're fresh off of a great victory with the Stop Bezos Act, so I'm excited to see what you can accomplish next. You are proposing an internet bill of rights. What would that actually include?
Well, I appreciate your mentioning Senator Sanders and I effort on Stop Bezos. 350,000 workers got a raise up to $15 an hour. The Internet Bill of Rights is very simple. It was a year ago that we had the Equifax breach, almost 6 months ago that you had Cambridge Analytica, and yet Congress has done nothing to protect people online. The Internet Bill of Rights puts forward 10 basic principles of what Congress needs to do to protect people's data, to protect their identity, and to make sure that they have access to the internet and access to freedom of expression. I worked on it with Tim Berners-Lee, who is the founder of the World Wide Web, in addition to a lot of nonprofit groups and academics. And my hope is it will inform legislation in the Congress next session.
So several of the components of the Internet Bill of Rights have to do with allowing people to opt into certain types of information being taken by the companies, not taking information that's not actually necessary to provide the service that the website purports to serve, various things like this. And we know that a lot of these companies take this information very aggressively and then either utilize it or sell it. And many of them seem to think that their future in terms of revenue comes from things like this. So I'm curious, has there been much pushback against your new bill from these companies that seem to think that they need this for monetary purposes?
There has been pushback from some of these companies saying that it's too onerous or that they can't do that. But as you pointed out, there's no reason when we connect to the internet through our internet service provider that the internet service provider needs to know information about our preferences. There is no reason that when we are giving our information to a social media company that we shouldn't have to first consent before giving that information. So I think in the long run, these companies need to realize that the era of the Wild West with no regulations is over. We're going to need well-crafted regulations, and they can come to the table and be part of that, or they're just not going to be part of the discussion, but something is going to get done.
Yeah. It certainly feels like for a long time, we, I guess in terms of both the regulations and we as individuals, gave a lot of faith and trust in the hands of a few tech CEOs. And I think people are probably starting to rethink that. I mean, I know Mark Zuckerberg was in, you know, the halls of Congress not that long ago. And what did you think about his performance? How much personal trust and faith do you think that we as individuals should place in the motivations of these CEOs?
Well, look, we can admire what they've accomplished, but we shouldn't be putting the security and citizenship rights of Americans in the hands of 30-something CEOs. It's just unrealistic. The job is of Congress to craft the rules to protect our rights online. And so I think the challenge was with the Zuckerberg hearings, that Congress didn't seem up to the task. People were asking some very basic questions. How does Facebook make money? Or how does the platform work? And so people watching were left with a sense that we weren't up to the job. And we were asking Zuckerberg, what rules should we have? I mean, when would you ask an industry to write their own rules? I think instead what we need to do is look to independent experts, people like Tim Berners-Lee, academics, to draft rules that are going to protect American values online. And not defer to tech leaders who may be self-interested in the type of rules they want.
Yeah, I felt much the same as you were just expressing during that meeting. And when it comes to these tech issues, like very particular things about how the internet should be regulated, what rights we should have, I don't want to come across as ageist, but it seems in the case of some of these senators and congresspeople that it's going to be difficult to really believe that they fundamentally get it. And so I'm curious, do you think that I'm misplaced in that belief? Do you think that even these older congresspeople that you know grew up in an age far before the internet can truly get it? Or is this one of the reasons that perhaps we need younger blood moving into elected office?
I think it is one of the reasons we need younger blood, and that's not an ageist perspective. I mean, just like Congress shouldn't be dominated just with young people, it shouldn't be dominated just with people over 60. It should be reflective of the American people. And right now, we don't have enough people in Congress in their 20s and 30s and 40s. I also think you don't need computer scientists. You don't need people who understand how to code. You need folks who have actually used these platforms and not delegated it to staff. How many members of Congress do interviews with TYT? I mean, some of the members of Congress here would be intimidated just with that. So you couldn't make the rules for driving on the road if you've never been a driver or a passenger. And what you have right now is a situation where many of these members aren't immersed in these platforms and they're being tasked with making the rules of things they've never used.
Yeah. And I agree. I assume that even Skyping in this way for some would probably be difficult, actually. So thank you for doing that. You mentioned the Equifax breach, and earlier I was talking about the Facebook one as well. It seems like even in the cases like with Equifax, where we're talking about like the most important types of information, huge numbers of people's data being breached, the actual consequences seem sort of minimal. Like you can work them into your working budget as a corporation. Do you think that it's time to rethink that in terms of either massively increasing these fines, or should we be talking about the possibility of people being sent to jail when things like this happen?
Well, I do think we need real penalties with teeth, and the have to empower the FTC to have fines that are more than a slap on the wrist. And I think there should be criminal liability if it's willful. I mean, I don't think you can be sending people to jail for just negligence or things that aren't willful. But certainly if there's a willful decision of prioritizing profits over people's safety, then there should be criminal exposure. But I think a lot of this can be solved by having clear rules. I mean, these companies are operating with no rules. Europe has the GDPR, so it can be done. Different states, California has finally adopted rules. It's time for the Congress to act. And I think once we take back the House majority, people are going to expect with the first 100 days for us to act.
I certainly hope so. One of the components of the Internet Bill of Rights has to do with net neutrality, which we know, obviously, the Trump administration moved about as far from the Obama administration's position on that as is possible. Some states, thankfully, are stepping up on that area. How confident are you that if there is a shift of power in November, that we can actually get that reasserted at the national level?
I'm quite confident because you can have even reasonable Republicans who believe in net neutrality. All net neutrality is, as you know, is the right to access the internet without being charged unfairly or without being discriminated. It's actually a pro-entrepreneurship policy, pro-innovation policy. You don't want AT&T or Charter or these big companies getting one rate to access the internet mm-hmm. and stifling competitors or new entrants by charging them an arm and a leg. And you want to make sure that, let's consider TYT, you want to make sure that you can have access to the internet to have your broadcast and that you aren't forced out by huge fees because NBC or ABC or some of the CNN are trying to make rates too expensive for you. Yeah. So anyone who cares about democracy, access, innovation ought to be for net neutrality.
Okay, I certainly agree. I have one other question. So most of the planks of the Internet Bill of Rights have to do with either protections from unnecessary harvesting of your data, data portability, things having to do with your information, the information you're putting out there. Do you believe that there should be any sort of inclusion of concern over what information you're being presented with? So obviously in the last election, we had issues with fake news and various platforms have been doing some things to try to curb that. Should that be a part of this conversation?
I do. I'm not sure it necessarily has to be part of the Internet Bill of Rights, but it definitely needs to be a part of the broader conversation about the obligation of social media companies. They are new media companies. They need to hire humanists and people schooled with ethics and journalism to see what obligations they have to fact check, to make sure that propaganda isn't reshared or retweeted and have misinformation out there. There has to be some set of standards in new media companies to make sure that the platforms are contributing to democracy, not undermining them.
Well, Congressman Rokana, author of the Internet Bill of Rights, thank you for joining the show again.
Thank you for having me back.
Thank you. We are going to take a short break. When we come back, who is the most bullied person in the world after this? Welcome back to the Damage Report, everybody. I am still Johnny Derella, I guess. It hasn't really changed over time. So I want to turn now to bullying, okay? Now, we know that the First Lady, that has been her thing, is concerned about bullying, and in particular, cyberbullying. And so she started her hashtag BeBest campaign, which I haven't looked into it. I'm sure it's rolling along and being very successful. But she was interviewed recently about this sort of thing by 2020. This is Tom Lamas was talking to her about what her experience with bullying has been, and this is what she had to say.
What is it about social media? Because I remember you talking about this during the campaign. What happened to you personally, or what did you see personally that you thought you wanted to tackle this issue?
I could say I'm the most bullied person on the world.
You think you're the most bullied person in the world?
One of them, if you really see what people are saying about me.
You're an adult. You say you're strong. Have you thought about what would this do to a child, to my son, to other children?
That's why I, you know, my BeBest initiative is focusing on social media and online behavior. We need to educate the children of social emotional behavior so when they grow up and they know how to deal with those issues. That's very important. Also with opioid abuse, we have a big crisis in United States.
So a couple things there. So we need to educate the children with socio-emotional stuff so that when they grow up, they know how to deal with that. I agree. I would start with Don Jr. personally, based on his constant cyberbullying. I know that you're not going to fix Donald himself right now, but maybe with the sons, you might have a little bit more sway. But I want to go back to what she said earlier on, and that is that she is the most bullied person in the world. Really? Are you really the most bullied person? Because, look, I don't have to think too hard to come up with at least a few candidates that might be able to challenge you for that title. I mean, let's bring up this Newsweek article. She might, you know, have something to say about that. This is, it's Christine Blasey Ford, I think is pronounced. She still can't return home because of continuous death threats. And by the way, look, receiving any death threats is certainly awful. Receiving death threats because you accuse someone of sexual assault is even worse. But imagine receiving death threats because you accused a man of sexual assault. The people who like him won. He's now on the Supreme Court. He's going to be there for decades. You lost, and they're still sending you death threats. That is a very weird position from which to want to kill a person. But they're managing to do that. So, look, is Melania not aware of Christine Blasey Ford? Does she not know that name? I find that a little bit hard to believe. And so the idea that she is the most bullied person in the world seems certainly a little bit weird. I mean, we can certainly think of others, I guess. I mean, the kids that still haven't seen their parents in months down near the border, they probably consider that a little bit of governmental bullying. The kids that we bombed in Yemen, we helped to blow up a bus full of kids. I mean, granted, they can't be bullied anymore, but they were certainly bullied by the Saudi government. And look, the list goes on and on and on. And you could include, you know, Deborah Ramirez and Julie Swetnick and any number of other people who are constantly bullied. But Melania thinks that she is the worst in terms of that. Now, maybe she'll consider this video to be bullying. And look, I get it. Nobody wants to attack the First Lady. It looks bad. It makes you look bad. I probably look bad doing it. But we also have to understand that there is a narrative out there that, sure, Donald Trump is bad, and sure, his sons are the worst, and Jared seems to suck, and even Ivanka seems complicit with this, but not Melania. Melania, she's the one that's stuck with them. Like, she's probably really a good person. Forget the fact that she agreed with Trump on the whole birtherism thing, and she defended him when he was accused by literally dozens of women of sexual assault himself. She is still awful amidst all of this new stuff. Please just bear that in mind. She wants to be the voice asking for people to have, you know, concern over bullying and everything, but she is aiding and abetting some of the worst cyberbulliers in the history of the internet right now. And that continues up and until today. The bullying. Play this video. See if you remember this.
What he's going through. 36 years ago, this happened. I had one beer. How did you get home? I don't remember. How'd you get there? I don't remember. Where is the place? I don't remember. How many years ago was it? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. Upstairs, downstairs, where was it? I don't know. But I had one beer. That's the only thing I remember. And a man's life is in tatters. A man's life is shattered. His wife is shattered. His daughters, who are beautiful, incredible young kids. They destroy people. They want to destroy people. These are really evil people.
Yeah, these are really evil people, and they're standing behind you, and they are laughing and cheering and holding up signs as you are literally attacking a survivor of sexual assault over the fact that she doesn't remember, to your satisfaction, the particular details of what happened to her. And of course, you could do the fact-checking, the specific things that he says she can't remember, she did actually talk about on there. Fine, regardless, forget about that. So is Melania, does she not know that this happened? She literally lays next to the man that mocks in front of tens of thousands of people the experience of a sexual assault survivor. And you might say, okay, look, she doesn't believe Christine Blasey Ford. They all don't believe Christine Blasey Ford, and it's just one woman. Is it really that bad that he mocks her? But he has moved so far beyond that. The default position of Donald Trump and much of the right now is that the Me Too movement needs to be punched in the face on a regular basis. And they will do that not just in sort of obvious ways, but in bizarre, subtle ways as well, as you'll see in this clip.
I got it. Every Republican, I'd use an expression, you know, there's an expression, but under the rules of Me Too, I'm not allowed to use that expression anymore. I can't do it. It's the person that got away. See, in the old days, it was a little different. Pennsylvania says do it anyway. I would do it, except for these people up there. They would say, did you hear what President Trump said? Did you hear what he said? So there is an expression, but we'll change the expression. Pennsylvania was always the person that got away.
The men laughing in the background. The Me Too movement. Also, the person that got away, I guess the expression is the one that got away. That doesn't seem too offensive. I think that you're allowed to say that. Maybe you think it's the girl who got away. That doesn't seem that bad. What was he actually thinking the expression was if he needed to self-censor in that case? So look, the issue here is the constant mocking and bullying is coming from inside of the White House. If she actually wanted to do something about that, she has an opportunity literally every day. She has all these people on her phone. She can text them if she wants to. So while I like that you have had some sympathy for Melania, you are good progressives, you are filled with compassion for people, sometimes the people you feel this compassion for don't necessarily deserve it. And there are a lot of people that could use your empathy and your sympathy. Save it for the people that actually deserve it. With that said, we're going to take a break. We come back. Voter suppression is coming up right before the election. We'll break it down for you. Welcome back to the Damage Report, everybody. You know what? Let's take a second from our prepared stories. And you're seeing down there right now. Some good news for you. Two bits of good news, actually. The first is what you're seeing in right here. That's Washington State strikes down their death penalty. So five of their justices said, and this is the second bit of good news, that the death penalty is invalid specifically because it's imposed in an arbitrary and racially biased manner, which is even better than the first bit. So look, any state that gets rid of the death penalty, certainly a good thing, and it is a very slow process of getting more states to actually do that. Even states, by the way, that don't use the death penalty still keep it on the books for one reason or another. But if it is going to be overturned, that is exactly why it needs to be overturned, because we know from the experience of many people, including innocent people who've been executed in that particular way, that it is arbitrary, it is racially biased. Certain types of people are far more likely to get the death penalty than others. And so good job, Washington State, in striking that down. Now, it's interesting to note, the last time that they actually used the death penalty in Washington State was back in 1994. So it still took decades to actually get rid of it. But interesting bit of trivia. In 1994, when they killed Charles Rodman Campbell for two murders back in 1982, do you know how they did it? They hung the guy in 1994. Our government hung someone. Like, this is not 1894. This is 1994. This is not Red Dead Redemption. This is literally what our government does to people. So good job, Washington, in striking it down. Or if I can go back to my normal pessimism, perhaps temporarily striking it down, because we now have an even more conservative Supreme Court. So we'll see if that gets appealed, what they'll actually think about it. Sorry, I don't want to be too pessimistic. And with that, why don't we move on to more bad news, actually. So Georgia has a very important governor's race going on right now, and you have two very different candidates running in it. So you have Stacey Abrams, who is a great progressive candidate. I believe she's the first African-American woman nominee for the governorship of Georgia in history. She is running against Brian Kemp. That is Georgia's Secretary of State. Now, if you're not familiar with this, the Secretary of State of the states is different than of the country. The country, they deal with a lot of things. A lot of it is foreign policy. In the states, though, a lot of it is election laws, including voting laws. Who gets to vote, how they get to vote. And that's Brian Kemp, who does that, is now running an election, getting to set the rules for the election. And already, it is clear that he is doing it in a way designed to make it more likely that he actually wins. So right now, more than 53,000 voter registration applications are on hold in Georgia with just 1 month to go before the midterm election. More than 70% of those that are currently on hold are of African American voters, or I guess potential voters, because they might not actually get to vote thanks to the effect of Brian Kemp. So 70% on hold are African American. Georgia's population is 32% black. So you are far, far more likely than you should be based purely on the numbers to have your registration on hold right now. Thankfully, Stacey Abrams is doing a good job of helping to generate news coverage of the fact that this is obvious voter suppression going on in Georgia right now. She was in August, she was on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, and she called Kemp a remarkable architect of voter suppression. And by the way, this is what he's doing right now. But if you look back, Google voter suppression and Brian Kemp, this is something he has been doing for some time. And it actually is just the latest in a long tradition of Secretaries of State of Georgia doing this. Karen Handel previously had done the exact same sort of thing, both suppressing voter registration applications, committing voter purges and things like that. This is like their MO in Georgia, and they're going to continue to do that. By the way, 53,000 votes, you might think, okay, in a governor's race, that's a statewide race. Are we being a little bit petty in concerning ourselves with 53,000 votes? I think that that's an absurd thing to say, but I understand that some people might think it. Well, understand that every vote is going to count. Now, Kemp says that less than 1% of applications failed verification and were held up. And look, in a race that is going to be decided by a bunch of points, 1% of the voter registration applications might not matter. But as of right now, the race between Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp is considered a toss-up, according to a collection of many polls being done by Real Clear Politics. So as of right now, 1% could well be the deciding factor. There have been a number of races in the primary so far that's far closer than 1%. And when it comes to the governorship of an important state like Georgia, it is incredibly vital that everyone that wants to run actually gets to run. Now, right now, many people are getting involved to put pressure on Brian Kemp and the Republicans in Georgia to do something about this. The ACLU is doing a good job. They have been on the case of Georgia for some time, actually. Back in August, they accused one of the state's counties of trying to make it harder for African Americans to vote when the Randolph County Elections Board closed 7 of its 9 polling locations. That's a story that we covered at the time. And thankfully, with the pressure that the ACLU and other organizations and individuals put on them, they largely reversed that. But that does not mean that we are allowed to let down our guard. After the Supreme Court struck down key provisions of the Voting Rights Act a few years ago, it has been incredibly popular in southern states to do everything they can to wipe out people's ability to vote. And in races like this, especially historic races, like with Stacey Abrams potentially becoming the first female African-American governor, it is incredibly important. So continue to put pressure on them. Fast little story. We know that Donald Trump and the Republicans have been trying to scare people over MS-13. They talk about MS-13 more than MS-13 talks about MS-13. And it apparently is having an effect, not just in stoking more xenophobia amongst Americans, but even in terms of how they spend their money. So one of the things that he has said is that you don't just need to worry about MS-13 in LA or near the border, these big cities, but in Long Island. He keeps coming back to it. Long Island, Long Island, Long Island. They're invading Long Island, and it is having an effect. By the way, over the past few years, homeowners on the southeastern coast of Long Island have spent anywhere from between $60,000 to $200,000 on bulletproof safe rooms equipped with panic buttons to fortify themselves against potential home invasions. Now, this is something that rich, scared people have worried about for some time. But now, in particular with MS-13, that sort of spending is starting to skyrocket. We've got a quote from one of the general managers of a company that does these sorts of renovations and says, MS-13 is a major concern in recent years, and it's a growing concern. Most people are worried about multiple things. It could be home invasions, human trafficking, and obviously gang activity, especially on Long Island. Now look, if you're worried about gang activity, I'm not going to say that you're wrong. If you're worried about it even on Long Island, I'm not going to say you're wrong. But the idea that especially on Long Island, you should be worried about gang activity, that seems a little bit weird. And human trafficking is a serious problem around the world, but in the US as well. But I don't think that the principal place that human trafficking is happening is amongst the wealthy of Long Island. But look, if you have the hundreds of thousands of dollars to spend thanks to huge tax cuts, sure, put in a safe room if you want. They're so scared. This guy, John Katsimatidis, billionaire, former New York City mayoral candidate, I want to just delve very briefly into the mind of one of these voters. He says, I sleep with a gun underneath my pillow, a Walter PPKS, the same one James Bond carried. My wife Margot prefers a shotgun, although once she thought she heard something, got the shotgun out and shot through the door. And his next statement wasn't, so I asked her to no longer have a shotgun. So he carries a gun thinking that he's going to be James Bond. Look, I love James Bond. I want to be James Bond, but I don't actually buy his gun and put it in my house where I can potentially shoot my girlfriend. His wife has already randomly fired their shotgun through a door, but that's just how you want to live. If you're worried about MS-13, maybe somebody needs to get shot with a shotgun. So ridiculous use of money. Obviously, it should lead to both an actual conversation about the real threats of groups like MS-13 and possibly higher taxes on rich people who can clearly afford it. With that said, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, one more story for you. We're going to close out the show with a little bit of potential good news after this. Okay, so only minutes remaining. Look, this is the damage report. We deal with the threats that you face every morning. The idea is that I experienced early on in the Trump administration, you wake up and you never know what's going to hit you in the face. So we generally do cover bad news, but we will not acknowledge good news when it happens. Last week, we broke down a report showing that very few Americans actually pay much attention to what Donald Trump tweets. That was good news. When his poll numbers aren't good, we report on it. That is good news. And here's a little bit more for you. Coming from Politico, by the way, how often do we get to speak positively about Politico? So apparently, Fox News is moving on from live full coverage of Trump rallies. Not because they're bored with it, but because Trump supporters are growing bored with it. Viewership numbers for the primetime events have been roughly similar to and sometimes lower than the regularly scheduled programming on Fox News. And so why spend time covering it when you're paying high priced salaries for intellectuals like Tucker Carlson and you can just play them instead? Now, there's a few explanations as to why this might be. Part of it is just that the numbers are going down. Back in 2017, when Trump rallied much less frequently, his events sometimes would get as many as 4 million or more viewers on Fox News. He doesn't come close to that anymore. In a lot of cases, it's about half as much or slightly more than half as much. So some people are saying that he is just doing way too much rallying. And when you combine that with the fact that he basically says the same thing at every rally, why would you watch multiple times? Now, understand, I'm not claiming he does a stump speech. That implies that he has prepared remarks and he actually says them. But his rambling, bizarre pronouncements just sort of blend together after some point. And look, they're still somewhat popular. Millions of conservatives will watch them. But it is good news that they're starting to move on, at least in terms of entertainment, a little bit. And it's even better news that this is apparently causing concern for the White House. They're saying that during a crucial period with the midterms less than a month away, some in the White House told Politico that they're worried that the president is losing a primetime megaphone to his base. And here is where it gets a little bit weird and maybe a little bit scary. One senior White House official was unsure why the network would decide to cut away from presidential rallies, saying officials are planning to, quote, look into that. And wouldn't be surprised if White House Communications Director Bill Shine, a former Fox News executive, was in touch with former colleagues about the trend. So I want to mention two things here. One, Bill Shine moved from Fox News to the White House communications team. Hope Hicks moved from the White House to Fox News communications team. So it is possible that this sort of minor rift could be gotten past, considering the incestuous relationship between Trump and Fox News. But it does mean that, at the very least, they're going to have to start to be, in the short term, a little bit more creative if they want full-time coverage of everything that Donald Trump says and does. So, look, CNN and MSNBC have basically not been covering these rallies much at all. They're certainly not doing what they did in the primaries, where they play all of it. But if Donald Trump mixes it up and gets a little bit of star power, they suddenly will. So, literally, as we were filming the beginning of this show, Kanye West was doing a meeting with Donald Trump and CNN and MSNBC played the entirety of the thing, as Kanye West said deep thoughts like this: time is a myth. He said it. Hey, he's a rich intellectual. He's far smarter than me, everybody says. But time is a myth, which is the sort of deep thought that generally takes you being in freshman year of college and just being introduced to marijuana. But time is a myth. And so they did cover it quite a bit. Now, look, I'm gonna make a prediction. This is an effect of the midterms. And as we get closer to the presidential election, I do think that Fox News is gonna start to cover those more. I think that his supporters will start to be reinvigorated around what he's saying. I think that they're a little bit worn out right now. And when you combine that with the fact that they probably don't really think that much is at stake in these midterms, they're so used to winning at this point that they're getting sick with it. I do think that once you move into the presidential election and it's his ass on the line again, they might start to be a little bit more invested on a daily basis. So that is just a little prediction for you, and that's where it gets a little bit pessimistic. With that said, thank you for watching the show. Love it when you tune in. By the way, if you are listening to this, if you're not watching live, if you're on the podcast, please give it a 5-star review. Tweet me a screenshot. I will tweet you a funny GIF in response. Thank you again. We'll see you tomorrow morning with the last show of the week. Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.